Hello and welcome to another episode of Radio Free Nintendo. This is episode 427. I'm your host, Jonathan Metz, and with me, as always, are Guillaume Veillette.
Hey, hey.
James Jones.
Sup.
John Lindemann.
427 episodes. God damn!
And our special guest on special assignment, Mr. Curtis Bonds.
Little known fact, I am the sixth member of the DK crew.
Yeah, so Curtis is the main reason I wanted him to be on the show this week is because we're going to wrap up Guillaume's thoughts and at the end of New Business on DK64. And I don't think Guillaume likes it very much, but Curtis loves it. So
that might be a stretch. But
didn't you say
it
was maybe one of your favorite games ever?
Back in 2000, yeah.
Okay. Oh, you're going to qualify it. All right.
Yeah.
Anyway, we'll get to DK64.
Yeah.
All right. We will get to that in a little bit, and we've got some listener mail queued up for later in the show. But first off, it's time for new business, and I thought Curtis should actually kick this off because you played the hot new Mario Kart 8 DLC, and probably the rest of us haven't had time.
Yes, I did.
Because it's brand new.
I actually blasted through the new tracks. I haven't messed with the 200cc just yet because I was super, super tired when I first started the pack because I was planning on streaming it at when it went live at 9 o'clock in the morning, and I had actually taken some sleeping meds the night before, and by the time I woke up at around 8:45, I was like, no, I'm going back to sleep. But I actually went ahead and played through the new tracks. I actually streamed it on our Hitbox channel, and I really enjoyed them.
They're really good.
They are some of the best designed tracks, not only from just a general playing standpoint, but from a visual standpoint. It is absolutely stunning how much care they put into not only the new tracks, but how they reimagine some of the older ones as well. One of my favorite tracks of all time, this is my kind of controversial, but I actually really like Baby Park from Mario Kart Double Dash.
Oh, you're one of those people.
Yeah.
I'm a fan indeed. It's where all the battles happen.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that's the fun thing about that track. I mean, it's
you're
fun.
Always close to everybody else, so
exactly.
It's just mayhem
even
from start
when you're
to
multiple
finish.
Laps ahead, you're close to everybody else.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
it's so much fun. I love it.
Yeah, it's really, really fun.
Cue
when
up
I'm
the
playing
music
with
here.
It's the closest. You know why I like it? It's the closest thing to a functional battle mode that has
exactly.
been in that series since the N64 days. I think Baby Park is, didn't it start on the GameCube version, Double Dash?
Yep.
Yes. Baby Park was from
that was
Mario
the original.
Double Dash, yeah.
Yep. And, it's awesome. I mean, that game had a terrible battle mode. I mean, they pretty much all have ever since, 64, so.
You know what?
Maybe
Mario Kart DS's battle mode was fun when you actually had people to play it with. But,
maybe it's just that I've never really played it. Or not very much on DS. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I don't remember that one being especially great.
So I will say I've seen video of Baby Park on 200cc. It's stupid. It's so stupid. I can't. Like,
sub
10-second laps. It's just dumb.
Yeah.
That's going to be great.
Yeah, like I said, I haven't messed with the 200cc, but I can imagine it is absolute chaos. But
I'm excited about Cheese Land from Super Circuit.
Yeah.
Because that's one of those bitmap, games from either the Super Nintendo game or the GBA game that have never been rendered in real 3D before. And I know in the original set of courses that are in Mario Kart 8, I found that those were some of my favorites just because they really feel like brand new tracks.
Exactly.
There's little elements that kind of remind you, but they had so little to work with in terms of making this into a modern track that it's basically brand new, just with kind of a retro style to it, a look to it, because they want to show that it's inspired by those old games. And I really love those, so I'm very excited for Cheese Land, even though I don't even remember, that track in Super Circuit, but
yeah, whatever. that's the cool thing about the Cheese Land and Ribbon Road, both are from the Game Boy Advance version, and those two are really the only tracks that stood out to me from Super Circuit because they actually looked unique and different from just, you know, Luigi Circuit 1, 2, 3 that were from that game. But yeah, those were just like flat planes and they had a really cool aesthetic to them and they just feel like new tracks. Like, because like Donut Plains, SNES Rainbow Road, those feel like, okay, these are, you can see the Super Nintendo influences in those tracks, but these ones are just, it is absolutely amazing how they managed to just make them feel like they were made specifically for this generation of Mario Kart.
Yeah, they might as well be new. They might as well be new.
Exactly, yeah.
That's just what's cool about them. And yet they still have like a little bit of hint of retro. And then with the F-Zero, I'm very excited to play Big Blue because I'm a fan of Big Blue in pretty much every version of F-Zero. It's usually one of my favorite levels. And so I'm really excited to see this take on it in Mario Kart 8 once again. Now that with both packs, they've done an F-Zero level. This seems to me like a very telling nod towards fans of that series. I mean, to me, this means something. The fact that they've done it twice now.
You're getting your hopes up, Johnny.
It might even be the opposite. Maybe this is kind of their way of saying, you know what? You're never getting another F-Zero, but we're going to at least try to like, you know, give it a noble send off by kind of paying tribute to it in Mario Kart, which
also
is the series
that give us $5.
That actually lived. I mean, if you think about it, Mario Kart is a younger series than F-Zero. It hasn't even been around as long as that, but it's had way more games. And it's, I mean, Mario Kart is not going anywhere. It's going to be around for a very long time, whereas F-Zero seems to have just kind of fluttered away in the wind. And I wonder if this is a way of kind of picking up the torch a little bit. Even I mean, you could certainly optimistically read into it that it's some kind of smoke signal for fans. Hey, we're going to try to bring it back soon, guys.
Yeah, I think the reason.
You know, I wouldn't be surprised if this was something to like kind of test the waters of, you know, gauging whether or not F-Zero is actually as popular.
Yeah, but there's so much
as I think it is.
There's so much other stuff in that pack, though. It kind of muddies the water of what they'd be reading for. Like if they had just released a pack of like 3 F-Zero levels, you'd be like, okay.
Yeah, then you could compare the sales of it versus
right.
Yeah, true. But they could also notice maybe on like Miiverse like which courses that are shared the most, which are talked about the most, and stuff like that. And if they feel like so many people are talking about the F-Zero courses, then maybe they can gauge that as like okay, maybe people are interested in F-Zero because they kind of did that with when they re-released Star Fox 64 on the 3DS. They were talking about if this sells well, maybe we'll make another Star Fox. And, you know, here we are. There's another Star Fox coming out this year.
I guess they could look at when people select courses to race on online. They can see where people drop their preference. But, I don't know. It kind of reads to me like they're just like, oh, I guess we have to do this every so often. People are going to forget who Captain Falcon is in Smash Brothers.
Besides, something like that seems very high-tech, James.
John, that's... Save the digs for Act 2 when we have emails to the digs on.
Well, Curtis, why don't you tell us a little bit about this other game you've been playing? It's actually kind of a precursor to the whole Donkey Kong 64 bout that's coming up.
All right, absolutely.
Bout. Wow, you're hyping this up way too much.
Bout. Place your bets now.
Okay, so I have been spending a few weeks on Donkey Kong Country 3. Now, a lot of people have always kind of talked crap on this game, and, you know, I have in the past, mainly because I haven't really played it that much. Like, I was a big Donkey Kong Country fan, you know, back in the mid-90s. I was really excited for Donkey Kong Country 1, and I love Donkey Kong Country 2 even more, but for whatever reason, the third game just never really made much of a blip on my radar.
Yeah, like, well, I think that's the case for most people, just because the game came out after the N64 came out.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So it's late.
And that's because people don't listen to me when I tell them that it's actually probably the best. It's definitely my favorite of the three.
I knew it was out. Like, I actually played the game at a Toys R Us kiosk. But I don't even know what my opinion was of the game back then, because, you know, back then, I would just eat up anything that was a Nintendo franchise. Like, so I was just really confused when I was playing it on the Wii U Virtual Console as to why I just never thought to ask for this game for my birthday or Christmas or even rent it from Blockbuster.
Well, I think it's not just that the N64 came out, but people had played Mario 64, and I think that led a lot of people to just, I don't know, like sell off their Super NES or, well, okay, this is old now. It's not as interesting. I've played the future, and, you know, I'm done with Donkey Kong Country.
Yeah, well, I didn't even have an N64 until, like, 98, so I was kind of stuck with a Super Nintendo for most of my, like, you know, 90s gaming. And, yeah, Donkey Kong Country 3 just kind of came and went, and I, you know, even tried playing it through less than legal means, and never really got past maybe the second world. I just kind of dropped interest. But, you know, all three of the Donkey Kong Country games came out on the Virtual Console, and, you know, I just decided to give it another shot, because maybe paying for it will actually give me some more incentive to actually finish it. And I actually did end up finishing it, and I liked it a lot. So I don't know.
Are these out on the Wii U Virtual Console, or are they just Wii Virtual Console through Wii U Wii
Mode? They are on the Wii U Virtual Console now.
Okay.
Because, yeah, they actually dropped them from the Wii Virtual Console like a couple years ago and didn't really give a reason why. And all of a sudden, about a month ago, they just put them back on the Wii U Virtual Console. And, you know, you can still upgrade them if you bought them on the Wii service. And, yeah, I never bought it on the Wii service either, which is kind of weird. But, yeah, I completed the game. I'm still trying to find all the bonus coins and stuff like that and get to the secret world. But I really, really enjoyed it. Way more than I thought I ever would have. Cause mainly the thing that kind of turned me off was Kitty Kong or Baby Kong, whatever his name is.
He sucks. I mean, he's a bad character.
He's a baby.
He's a baby.
A bad character in the rare game? Are you?
Hey, watch never heard yourself.
It would have been better off just having it be Dixie and Donkey Kong. If they wanted a large character to accompany the smaller character, then use Donkey Kong. That's what the game is named after. Kitty Kong just doesn't really add anything.
Yeah, Kitty Kong is basically the Dill Pickles of the Donkey Kong Country series.
Where are we going now? I'm confused and scared.
I don't know. When I bring up Dill Pickles, anything goes. But anyway, I was really entertained by the game. I actually like it more than the first Donkey Kong Country game. I still think that 2 is my favorite game, if only just for the atmosphere. Cause I love just how creepy and alone you feel just going against all these just scary enemies and scary places and stuff like that. That really stood out to me in the second game. And the third game is way more lighthearted. It feels like you're at summer camp in the California Redwoods somewhere.
Yeah, you're riding a jet ski around on a lake.
Mm-hmm. And it feels more fun. It feels more fun and lighthearted and doesn't really feel like there's a lot of danger going on, except for maybe like a couple levels. But, you know, I did end up enjoying, you know, that sense. It feels more like just a fun adventure than maybe the first couple games. Like,
It's interesting that you bring that up, because I hadn't quite put my finger on it, but I've been playing Donkey Kong Country 2 on the Wii U just because I had it. I think my sister downloaded it once a long time ago when she was visiting on the Wii Virtual Console, and I figured, oh, I'll pay the dollar to upgrade it, and maybe I'll mess around with it. But I only ever like rented it back in the day, so this is my first time owning it and really trying to play through it. And I'm doing it just because everybody always says, well, it's the best one of the trilogy. And I don't really get it. I think there's something that I just don't care for in the mood of it. And I think you really put your finger on it. It is very like grim and foreboding and dangerous. And like whenever my mental image of this game will always be those damn spiky hornet guys.
Oh God. Yeah.
You get to a point, I think it's in the amusement park world where it feels like you're just like flying through mazes of these wasps, and it's a nightmare. And it's made this impression on me that's been with me since the 90s. And that's just not a pleasant image, you know, when you think about playing this game. It is really hard, but it's also just kind of like vicious. Maybe it almost has that Prince of Persia warrior within kind of vibe, you know. It's like a little
well, there's
too
no Godsmack. There's no Godsmack.
It's a bit too aggressively hold dark and
hold on.
And I wouldn't go that just, far. There's no metal thong in this.
There's no Godsmack.
It really is lacking in levity, though, especially compared to the first one.
Yeah, but
one.
I mean, yeah. you just it's compared a minor basically. Inconvenience to essentially murder. I mean,
it's not an inconvenience. I just
I'm talking about the scale of severity here. Like,
oh, yeah. Anyway, it's kind of keeping me from enjoying it too much. Mm-hmm. I think, but yeah, I'm glad you pointed out that contrast. All right. Well, we'll get back to Donkey Kong a little bit later, and we'll hear more from Curtis then. But okay. John Lindemann, tell me about what you've been playing this week.
Yeah, well, I mean, of course, we have the retroactive going on with Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess. So I just kind of wanted to give some of my early thoughts on it. I'm probably about maybe 6 hours into it. I still got a long ways to go, about probably 10 times that before I actually beat the thing. So yeah, so a lot of time will be spent this weekend on it for sure. Yeah, you know, it's really interesting because where I'm at, I've beat the first dungeon, which is actually quite good. It's weird going back playing these Wii games because first off, I mean, the first thing that hits you, of course, is the Wii-tastic graphics, which.
Well, these are straight up GameCube graphics because this is a GameCube game.
Yeah. I mean, it's looking every single bit of a 2006, 2007 era GameCube game. I mean, but Johnny and I talked about this on Twitter where Link himself looks really good. He's a really good looking character model. But
tons of detail, very sharp.
Yep.
Good facial animations. I don't know why.
Yeah.
They're not really useful not like in Wind Waker, but anyway.
I think they just carry – well, remember, this game is still technically running the Wind Waker engine, so they just probably just carried him over.
Mm-hmm. But, I mean, those environments. Wow. I mean – talk about Vaseline smeared all over the screen. I mean, there's a whole lot of muddy textures that
that's
just
how
look,
I do it, John.
Yeah, I mean, they look. They don't look bad far away, but they're It's one of those things where it's like it's good from afar, but far from a good. You know what I mean?
When you say far away, do you mean when Link is far away from them, or when you're far away from the
when
TV?
The camera that you're looking through like, is far away from these textures?
When you're looking at a TV from space with this game on, it doesn't look so bad.
Yeah, but I mean, it's at first I was kind of like, yeah, you know, it's funny because the formula, it seems kind of old now. It's a little bit on rails for me. I liked it more. I will say I liked it more as I went along, but it's just like the Zelda kind of like, you know, sort of kind of restrictive. You can only do this. Like, it's funny because I remember when these games, when they first introduced, like, you know, one of the things they were going for was, you know, for example, auto jumping. And that was because, you know, they wanted to make it as easy as possible for people to kind of go through this 3D space without having to worry about, you know, precise jumping, falling off of the ledge, not, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? That stuff just seems kind of like, it seems kind of quaint now. I get it, but when I play through these games now, like when I play through Twilight Princess, it seems a little bit restrictive. It's like things have moved, and this is what I'm hoping with the new game for Wii U. I mean, they're definitely going through. They're going towards open world, but I'm curious to see how much they go towards open world.
You want them to add a jump button?
I don't know what I want, but
because that's not going to happen.
I don't know.
It would be kind of amazingly crazy if they added a jump button to the new Zelda, but I don't really see it. I feel that they would think that it's kind of unnecessary. I think Nintendo probably looks at the jumping in Skyrim, for instance, and says, why would you bother?
Yeah, the jumping in
What's
Skyrim
What's the fucking
is,
point of jumping in Skyrim?
Agreed,
it's ridiculous.
But I think really what I'm driving at, probably not necessarily the jumping, but just kind of the exploration in general feels, you know, you're kind of hemmed in, but
for sure, yeah. Even like out on Hyrule Field,
yeah,
there's not that much to do out there.
Yeah, in the Hyrule Field, you're locked away from it for the first 2 hours of the game. You have to finish the first dungeon, and then you can go explore. Yep.
Even then, it's a very small part of it. I mean, that's one cool thing that they do about the field is they reveal it to you bit by bit as you play through the game, and once you finally have access to the entire Hyrule Field, it feels really open and cool. Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of, I think, hurt by the fact that there's these loading screens in between all those sections.
Yeah.
So it's not really one contiguous world. It's kind of more like, not like Monster Hunter, but you know what I mean. I mean, there's kind of zones that you run around in, and then, you know, then you pass through a little cutscene, and now you're in the other one, and you can't even see from one end to the other. I mean, there's no like world immersion there at all.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny you should mention Monster Hunter, because I was really getting kind of a Monster Hunter 4 vibe from it as I was playing through it. For some reason, it reminds me a lot. It's like Monster Hunter 4, amusingly enough, has kind of caught up to that sort of gameplay. You know, like, it's almost like it's caught up to the Twilight Princess, like, gameplay sort of thing, because its gameplay has been so hemmed in, and Monster Hunter 4 kind of tried to open up its gameplay a little bit in various ways, and now it feels more like Twilight Princess does to me.
Weird.
So, yeah, it was really weird, because I remember going through solving some puzzle or something, and I'm just like, why does this feel like Monster Hunter 4 to me? It's really, really freaking bizarre. And it's like, because in Monster Hunter 4, it's the same kind of thing. It's like auto-jumping, and, you know, you can climb up stuff, and, you know, it just has that kind of a Twilight Princess vibe to me, so that was really strange. But yeah, I mean, I'm enjoying it so far. I mean, you know, it's interesting just kind of seeing the things like, you know, the little sort of, you have to go around and collect the tears in every new area and kind of to sort of open it up. And they have like those kind of grindy little things in it. But yeah, I mean, overall that stuff is enjoyable. I mean, the puzzle solving is still really enjoyable, finding all the bugs and, you know, switching over to the wolf sense and all that stuff. I mean, it works. I don't know. I'll be interested to see as I get further into it whether or not the gameplay with the wolf right now is kind of at that edge where I kind of like it, but it also kind of annoys me in certain spots. Like, I don't, my mind isn't really made up on it, whether or not it's actually successful. You know,
you're so limited as the wolf.
Yeah.
I mean,
you can't even
do nearly as many things as when you're Link. So it feels, it feels really constrained.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like it's very linear in the sense that there's really only one or two things that you can do because the wolf is so, you know, but also those sections when you, especially the second one, when you're in Elden and you have to go through the town, trying to find those bugs, it took me like 2 hours.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no time limit, thankfully, but I was just so ready for it to be over. And even once I finally kind of got my sense of the whole area and figured out kind of what they were going for, and they had to go inside of each house individually and separately.
Yep.
Even then, it took a long time to actually go through all that and execute on it. And I felt it was not as much fun as I remembered it, I have to say. That part really, really concerned me. I thought that was kind of very weirdly designed area where there's almost no direction at all. It's a really confusing area. You can't. Because of the twilight, you lose so much detail on the environment that all those areas kind of look the same, and the map isn't being helpful, and it's really frustrating, I thought.
Yeah, it took me forever to find the piece of wood on the ground that I needed
to
light up.
That part's ridiculous.
To open up the I don't know, the basement. It doesn't even make sense. But it took me way too long.
Get your fetch quests out of my Zelda, Nintendo.
In a way, kind of like, you know, especially, you know, in those houses, it kind of constricts the camera angle, so you can't really necessarily see around, and things are pretty dark and muddy to begin with. So, yeah, so the jury's kind of still out for me on that, because, I mean, it's obviously a huge part of the game, but, you know, like you said, Johnny, it's interesting because, you know, you would think that, you know, shifting to that form would kind of open things up, but it actually really constricts you. Like, there should be it feels like you should be able to do a lot more than you actually can do. I mean, really, you can just dig. That's about it. I mean, you know.
And you run fast. I mean, that's what the wolf's good for. You dig and run fast.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, you can bash some stuff, but.
And
yeah.
Zelda games have shovels. So.
Yeah.
Why is he here?
Yeah, and I mean, another thing too is when they put you in wolf form, they really don't tell you how to do anything. I mean, when you first start off in the cell, I was like, how the hell? I mean, I remembered from playing through the whole thing before.
It took me like 10 minutes to figure out that I needed a waggle.
Well, that's the thing. Yeah, exactly.
Well,
they don't even tell you that.
Your brain's not attuned to Wii games anymore. Everything is
waggle.
Well,
yeah, that's definitely part of it. Mm-hmm. That's not my first instinct is to start shaking the controller.
Yeah,
you know? It really doesn't tell you anything. It's remarkable.
I bet 7 years ago it would have been. But I had to shake for this dumb shit. Yep, there it is.
Yep. I mean, and yeah, that was the thing. Like, I remember that, I have to destroy that box in the corner to climb, to dig out. But I was like, how in the hell do I do that?
That was my first instinct. And then the two attacks that the game had actually shown me how to use weren't working on it.
Yep.
Rough. But yeah, it's a hell of a game. I have a lot of thoughts that I'm holding back right now because I don't want to spoil our feature too much and spend too much time on it right now. But actually, Curtis, since we have you here, I'm curious, have you ever played Twilight Princess?
Yeah, I played it when it first launched on the Wii back in 2000. Well, I started playing it in 2007, but I never really got past maybe the third dungeon. For whatever reason, like, I enjoyed playing the game, but for whatever reason, when I got to, I think, probably the third dungeon, it became a bit too daunting for me.
It's like a hard game. I mean,
yeah, it just, the
I'm really surprised by how difficult it is. So
the dungeon I was in just seemed like really overwhelming and big, and I just kind of put it off for another day and just never really
that
got
day
back
never
back
came
to it. Yeah. But yeah, I would be willing to give that game another shot because I really liked what I played, and so many people love that game so much, and I want to see kind of the rest of it.
Yeah. Now, I am a big fan of the art style, I will say that.
What if it could render, you mean?
Yeah. And by that, I mean the Link model.
Oh, okay.
I think everyone except Link in this game is ugly as shit.
Pretty much, yeah.
I don't like these character designs, for
Agatha
sure.
Agatha has some weird, creepy fans.
Yeah, a whole lot of forehead in this game, too.
There's a lot of forehead.
Oh, my God.
Lots of forehead. Yeah.
There's an 8-year-old child who looks like Maud from Harold and Maud. I don't know what he's doing in there, but anyway, we will have a lot more on Twilight Princess in a few weeks, and I thought this would be a good opportunity to have John kind of talk about his early impressions going back to the game. Just would be a good reminder to everybody else to start playing it if you haven't already. And again, the forum thread is out there. Again, I think it's a pretty challenging game, much more than I remembered. If you do get stuck, which a lot of people will, don't feel bad about it. Go to the forum threads. It's a great place to do it. Ask your question, get a little bit of help, read other people's experiences, and maybe even avoid getting stuck a couple of places.
You're getting soft, Johnny. Charlie's in the bush getting stronger.
What?
Yep.
Wow.
We're all in trouble. So, James, let's move on with your new business.
Sure. So, I've been doing a bunch of wrap-up on stuff that I've been talked about on the show. Cleared out about 3 games this week, so I'm feeling pretty good about myself.
Wow.
One of them, I wanted to make a quick correction on, Inazuma 11 on 3DS, is not the 1-2-3 release that I said it was during the show. This is actually the 1-2-3 release from Japan, which is just the DS games where they've changed the animations to be 3D. They're still DS animations. And that's it. This is just the one of that 1-2-3, meaning that nobody in the West will ever get to play 2 and 3, apparently. However, so if you already played 1, there's no reason to bother. It's the same game. All they've done is they've made the animation 16:9 in 3D. That's the only difference. If you haven't played 1, it's fun. I enjoyed playing through it again. It only took about 7 hours, but that's partly because I've already learned how all the dumb stuff you can do to sort of exploit the game. There's definitely some rough spots, like there's no quick continue if you lose a match on shootouts, which means you've already dumped 30 minutes in, plus whatever videos were in front of the match, and ultimately you lost because of a random number generator. That really sucks. But all in all, it was still a pretty good experience. I had played the game in about 4 years, so it was fun to go back to. So, moving on. New game. I actually have been playing, it might be my first Wii U game in a while, I've been playing Affordable Space Adventures, which came out last week, I think, on the eShop. Nintendo's been pushing this game since at least E3 last year. I know it's had a couple release date slips, but basically the idea is that you are on a Gold Rush-style expedition into space where you signed up with this company that essentially rents out these small exploration ships, shoots a whole bunch of them up to a planet, and then you go stake your claim. And the entire game is presented with these sort of like marketing materials that kind of feel like maybe you're being scammed. It'll get like, we've had no accidents since 1993. And you look like, wait, what?
Yeah. Or they show you the manual for the spaceship during load scenes. And it's like the first thing that they tell you about is like the glove box, the glove compartment.
Yeah. About like way deep in the game, there's a video that's, it's just still images of pictures of a woman. And it's like, she's like manager of safety for the company. And like, everything's so safe. They sent me on a long vacation. It's a postcard of her at the beach. Look at that martini. It was great. It's like, wow. But what actually happens is the mothership that's carrying all these small individual ships for staking your claim crashes on the planet, of course. All the small ships, which I think the ship you're piloting is actually called Small Ship TM, is the only one that survives, and you have to try to escape the planet. Meanwhile, the entire planet is populated with these artifacts that they explain are from an alien race. However, the government's really asked you not mess with them. Also, don't worry, they're totally safe. Except they're not. They're constantly trying to kill you.
Yep.
Basically, what the idea is you're put in these, it's 2D environment, and you have to navigate through these, you know, basically this 2D world. And throughout the world, there are these artifacts, and different things will draw their ire and essentially instantly kill you. Some of them you can't be generate, like they're activated by heat entering their area of, their area of sight. Some of them it's sound. Some of them it's electricity. So you're constantly having to manage the systems on the little ship to try to keep it within the tolerances of this thing you're about to pass through as you sort of solve environmental puzzles so you can move on to the next area. It's a bunch of really small areas chained together, essentially one segment of maybe it's like three or four puzzles, and then you go to the next area. So you're constantly contending with trying to manage your ship and solve these puzzles and not die. It is a synchronization of action is the hardest thing in this game. You may know exactly what it is you need to do. And you may know exactly how it is you need to do it. Like you may see that, oh, the floor here is sloped really hard and that thing I need to pass through sees everything. So I have to have all of my ship systems off when I pass through. Well, how do I do that? Well, I go to the very top of this ramp. I put on a landing gear that's slippery. And then I just jam the engine and I up my mass. I use my mass generator so I build up a ton of momentum and then kill the engine right before I pass through its area of sight. Yep. Skirt and fly over it and just land on the other side. Then right when I hit the wall, I need to hit the sticky landing gear and cling to the wall. That's like 9 actions you have to take in the exact right timing. And it's really hard. Yeah. Like, so you'll get shot flying through the space because you forgot to turn the engine off, or you were using the gas engine as opposed to the electric engine, and that one doesn't dissipate heat as quickly, or you've turned on the heat shield, so it's holding all the heat inside the ship, and it overheats and explodes halfway down the ramp. There's just all these things you have to manage, and...
All sounds extremely realistic to me.
No, yeah, it's super realistic.
Sounds like my day job.
Knowing what's going on and anticipating, like, how you have to do it is obscene sometimes. Like, I understand why space equipment has these automation systems that just cue stuff up on like extreme, like microsecond levels of like, do this, do this, do this, do this, because no person could ever hope to do it. It is impossible. There is so much as you get more deeper and deeper into the game, they just keep introducing new components to your ship. And the explanation being that the little ship is self-repairing from the initial crash and just putting systems online as you go. And there's just so much stuff to manage at the point I'm in now. I'm 4 or 5 hours into the game. I've probably got 13, 14 different systems at this point. And, you know, maybe I run one too hard and I overheat and explode. Maybe I cause my generator to go nuts and it just shuts down everything in the middle of a puzzle and I just crash to the ground, fall through a laser and die. I mean, there's just so many things going on that just managing them could be a real chore. And meanwhile, you're going through these very dark caves and trying to use the headlight on the little ship just to kind of get a feel for where you need to go. And sometimes it's so dark you can't see.
Mm-hmm.
The game is constantly putting you in environments where you feel like, I can't tell what's going on. And I don't know how to get through here, and I have to just try stuff, knowing that you're going to die a lot.
So is this fun or just hard and frustrating?
It can be very fun. It can be very frustrating. There is there are situations where the timing needs to be so exact that it just feels like the game is being a jerk. It's, you know, your tolerance is super, super, super minute. And there's like four or five steps. Now, the game checkpoints heavy. So if you fail, you're probably going to be dropped right before that thing you just attempted. But that can still be somewhat frustrating when you're doing it 4, 5, 6, 10. Right before we started, there was one where I jumped past one of these things twice on the way up and on the way back after hitting a switch, only to realize that I wasn't supposed to jump back the second time, that there was something below that the bad lighting didn't let me see. So I had to jump back again and go down the tube. It was like, oh, seriously? God damn it.
Sounds like you need to get good.
It's just, it's, the game wants you to turn the gamma down super low. And I think I'm just going to go back there and turn it up a little bit. Because a lot of times, yeah, it's just hard to see stuff. Like, you're just like, why is it this dark?
Yeah, so I've also been playing it, and I don't think I'm as far as you, James, but I've been playing it co-op. You can play with up to two other, well, up to three players.
Yeah.
And so playing it two players, it divides the, like, basically one person pilots the ship, the other person controls the systems and the flashlight. And I think that if you've got a third person, then the flashlight is given to someone else. But yeah, like, it's... It doesn't make the game easier because you're controlling the same spaceship, and unless you share the same brain, like, you're not going to be synchronized enough to actually pull a lot of these maneuvers off.
I would think that the only way to handle it would be before you attempt it, you talk out what you're going to do, and everybody just needs to do their role when it happens.
And I'm not very... And I'm not very good at communicating when I'm playing a game. I'm just like, hey, there, that. That thing. And just like, yeah. I lose. Well, anyway, not that I'm. Yeah.
Bad timing.
Case in point. Yeah, exactly. Case in point.
You wouldn't be able to talk this stuff through in real time. You'd have to plan ahead.
No. Yeah, you have to plan ahead. So the game is fun. I'm playing it on easy. There are, difficulty settings. But easy doesn't seem to be all that easy. So
I'm not sure what just a warning. What the difference is. Maybe it's just there's more of the hostiles around. So I went through an area just recently where
maybe they're less sensitive to whatever, you know, heat or electricity that you're putting off too.
Yeah, everything sets these things off except a tiny amount of heat you can get through. So you're constantly having to close your heat shield and hold all the heat inside the system and dissipate at these tiny areas where there's no oversight. And it goes on for so long. He just like, I got to the bottom and just like, yeah, finally, god damn, and just turned the game off and came upstairs and recorded a podcast. But like, that feels so good when you get something like that. There is a mix of just execution, like where execution is incredibly difficult and can be rewarding, and just sometimes looking at something going, how the hell do I solve this? And figuring it out is the reward. It's only the situation where figuring it out super easy and execution is super hard that I think it can get really frustrating.
Yeah.
And that's when I sit there and go, I don't want to do this anymore. But but once you get through it, usually you'll go, like, if I get stopped, I'll usually have 4 or 5 rooms after that where I clear out pretty easily. And then I'll get to another place where I get stuck for a little while. So, I mean, I cruised through about 6 or 7 rooms in about an hour earlier today. And I think I'm probably, you know, about 30 in at this point. So I don't know how long the game is. I'm having fun on single player. I definitely can see how playing this game single player and multiplayer isn't necessarily more or less difficult, just different.
Yeah. Different, yeah.
Because I'm
that's really cool, though. I mean, that could even make it worth. I don't know. Are these puzzles such that you feel like once you've done it once, you wouldn't really be interested in going back and doing it again?
Maybe.
Even with this different experience of having,
I mean, there's a lot of them. And it's not necessarily like explicitly like here is a puzzle. It's kind of environmental stuff. So yeah, I could see pretty easily forgetting the specifics of a given puzzle. It does make really good use of the gamepad though, because all of these system controls are on the gamepad controller. So, you know, you queue up your engine. So you've got two engines. You have an electric and a gas, and the gas makes a nice, satisfying mechanical rhythmic thumping sound, whereas the electric is just kind of a nice electrical hum to it. There's lots of great sound design in this game.
Yeah.
But like, you look, okay, I'm going to pull up my, I'm going to run my gas engine right now. I'm going to devote you know, 3 bars of energy towards thrust. I'm going to devote 2 to a stabilizer, which just sort of stabilizes you laterally. So if you turn that off, the engine is causing vibration in the ship, and it's really hard to fly straight. And I'm going to devote nothing to the mass generator. Well, you'll see that's causing your heat to go up every time you rev the engine to move. That's causing your noise to go up because the engine, that engine's super loud versus electric, which is super quiet. So you're having to kind of manage these things at that kind of micro level and understand how each system attached to each engine impacts both the physics of the craft, the performance of the craft, as well as those 3 indicators. It's really, it can be really complicated in some of these areas where you're looking at something and it's like, it will only let you pass through if you are dead silent, but throwing out no electricity. Look at what? That means I can't use the electric engine.
Right.
But the gas engine's super loud. How do I pull this shit off? And then you realize the answer is you have to go super high, build up a ton of momentum with the, like the mass generator, and just kill it.
Yep,
and
coast.
And just slam through the space and hope you land every part of it right. In some cases, it wants you to free fall and bounce off something like a rock, a promontory. And just bounce off and arc over the thing. You're like, oh my god, this game.
Jeez.
This game is
this sounds awesome.
It's
I'm a little intimidated, but also
it does a very I'm really good excited job to see of all this. Showing you giving you a system one at a time. You start it and all you have is the gas thruster.
Good.
I cannot imagine how the game would be more difficult than, you know, your day job. I think you'll be fine.
Exactly, Johnny.
My day job is reading and writing documents a lot of the time. So
yeah, I heard you can't read, Johnny. What's that? That's the rumor on Twitter. Yeah, also,
and it's really tough when you can't read.
Yeah, but you're an inspiration. You're an inspiration,
man. There is a little satisfying thing of every time the small ship blows up or is destroyed or crashes or overheats, it just gives you a friendly little notice about an update on the small ship, what happened when you respawn. So they'll be like, the small ship was smashed into 1,000 pieces. Or just like, was shot by unidentified craft. It's just like, yep, that happened. And you can just pull them up and see them all on this little history report.
Oh, nice. Well, we're probably going to be talking about Affordable Space Adventures again next week because I bought the game, have not played it yet, but I'm getting a weekend visit from our friend, Mr. TYP. And I really want to play some of this with him, as well as the Mario Kart and Smash Brothers and a bunch of other things. So we'll probably have another chance to talk about this game.
Yeah, I'm definitely getting a multiplayer opportunity with somebody who knows a little bit about this field too. So
awesome. Awesome. All right. Well, I'm going to go up next in new business. Shouldn't take too long. I've really only been, other than Twilight Princess, which we talked about, I've really only been playing Box Boy. And, I spoke about it very briefly a couple weeks ago. I had just barely touched it. I've played a lot more now. And, I'm at like chapter 14 or 15 or 16, something like that. And I think there's still actually a pretty fair chunk of the game to go. I guess one thing I wanted to mention about Box Boy is that there seems to be a lot of it. So if you really love this kind of thing, there's got to be hundreds of levels in this. And I'm fine with that, I guess. I have to say, I mean, I'm enjoying Box Boy. I like it. I don't love it. And I think I do like how it's kind of very bite-sized. A lot of the levels only have 2 or 3 little things that you have to do, and they're fairly discrete puzzles, basically, you know, but they all involve essentially you climbing over or jumping over a gap, or getting through a gate. So it's all like very micro-sized platforming challenges. Okay, I need to make a little bridge here, but it doesn't go far enough. And so I have to wait for this other thing and then I can jump from my block, you know, or use teleporters. Like every world has a different kind of mechanic that the level designs are focused on. So they mix it up. It, you know, it feels a bit like maybe, I don't know, Mario Galaxy in that way, where a lot of, or Galaxy 2, where it feels like a lot of levels are like very much oriented around, here's this one mechanic that, you know, we're going to build a whole bunch of crazy stuff around. This stage is all about flipping gravity, you know, and then you play through those levels and then you move on to the next world. And that, that element maybe never even comes back. You know, it's very kind of boxed in this way, or put into these buckets of game design, I suppose. And they don't seem to really cross pollinate too much. So the game has this kind of very singular focus, on whatever you're doing at the time. And that keeps it feeling very simple. And very straightforward, even as it gets more difficult, definitely, as you go forward, and as it continues to introduce more and more and more of these different mechanics. So I'm enjoying that part of it. I think a big problem for me is just the aesthetic. I mean, it seems really cool at first, and I don't mind the super simplistic approach that they took with Box Boy, but there's literally no color in the game. It is entirely black and white. And after playing it for several hours, basically getting through all these different worlds, it starts to feel very monotonous. You know, I mean, it is monotone. There's just no variation, and even as you, it feels like what you're doing in the game has changed a lot from world to world because the mechanics are, there's so many of them, and some of them are very different and really cool. But every level essentially looks exactly the same because it just has such a simplistic art design that there's just not a whole lot it can do. And you might think that these unlockable costumes that they talked about in the Nintendo Direct would help with that, but they really don't that much because you unlock those access to those costumes to buy them in the little in-game shop with your diamonds that you collect. Rapper. Really, there aren't very many of them. I mean, I'm up through a very, very solid chunk of the game, and there's only like three or four costumes that you can pick from. So even if you change those like every couple of levels, it doesn't feel like it adds that much variety. And the animations even on those costumes are really simplistic. So the game, I feel like the game is just kind of, it's a little too stripped down in the presentation for my taste. Obviously they went after a very deliberate style, but I think also probably a very cheap and easy style.
I mean,
and it feels like it's, yeah, you're paying for the levels here. There's not a whole lot else to Box Boy. Box Boy is not going to become anybody's favorite character, okay? There's just not that much personality to it, unfortunately. But it's a very fun puzzle platformer, and it's like if you like that on the basis of just that, then it's definitely worth playing.
I mean, my takeaway on that game was that ultimately that game is just a concept that they wrapped. Like they just left in what was essentially the proof of concept graphics and called it a day.
Yeah.
Yeah, because Nintendo's talked about how they kind of developed game systems and programming how it plays before they start putting mm-hmm. characters in it. So I wouldn't be surprised if this was just something they kind of had as a placeholder for an eventual franchise, you would say.
Yeah, and also this is a HAL game, right? So that's kind of how they work. Like that's Kirby was kind of a placeholder. I'm sure they've modified them a little bit.
The tricky part would be what would they have put in place of something that replicates itself so it can jump on itself?
Well, it's not. I mean, the box shape is fine. I just feel like there's even like two or three other characters who kind of join your quest, whatever your quest is. There's no actual story, but they keep introducing there's a girl box who shows up, and all she does is follow you around on the world map. I mean, she's completely useless. She doesn't do anything. She doesn't have any kind of personality to her. And then later you get this taller box that follows you around. And they just, why are these, there's nothing to it. You know, like it they play it off as being kind of mysterious, and maybe there's this amazing story set up in the end. But to me, this feels like maybe even less story than the Bit Trip series, which for me was way beyond minimalist in its storytelling.
Yeah.
To the point of you basically, I don't, you tell me there's all this whole narrative to Bit Trip, and I'm like, sure there is, buddy.
Like Atari 2600 I know the creators. Games.
That's when the weed came out.
I know the creators like, you know, talk about this character and how he's on an emotional saga or something. And I'm like, yeah, whatever. It's a fucking big black square with rainbows coming out of it. I don't know what you're talking about.
That's what they called me.
Anyway, yeah. So, I mean, rainbow shooting out of things would be a big upgrade to Box Boy. I mean, it's bland. It is drab. And that's really my only criticism of it. Otherwise, I like it a whole bunch. And I think it's like $5. I mean, there's a lot of content to it. There's a lot of fun and interesting levels to it. So I think for the price, it's worth checking out. It's worth taking a risk on it for sure.
Yeah, it's definitely worth the $5. I mean, I only got to play it a little bit, but I've been really enjoying it. But I had to send in my new 3DS XL to Japan so I can get it modded for video capture. So I don't have it anymore.
It'll come back.
Yeah, eventually.
All right. Well, let's wrap up new business with Guillaume.
Yeah, so I'm taking a break from FPS games just for a little bit. I was away during the weekend, so I was away from my consoles.
Going soft.
You know, I was away from my consoles. There's not really anything on portables.
Ironfall.
No, thanks. Also, it's not first person. It's not first person, and I know I would catch shit from John just for that.
I mean, at least it's got
shooter. I appreciate that. Guillaume's a purist now.
It's got- hey, Moon Chronicles is actually very much in line with some of the stuff you've been playing lately.
Yeah, but you've really been selling that game to me, Johnny.
Moon Chronicles, Jonathan Metz, ready for Nintendo.
I kind of like it. I kind of like Moon Chronicles. I don't hate it.
So anyway, what I've been playing is the new Street Pass games. First of all, even if you're not planning on buying the new Street Pass games, if you have the old ones, you should go and do the update, because they kind of patch in a few features that make the games go a little bit faster. You can skip some cutscenes, at least in the like the Space MiiForce game. And they also do something where, let's say you got like 5 street passes on a good day and you want to just top it up to like 10. You can do that in one shot. You can do like the find max, like fill up the thing. It uses, you know, it will fill up the 5 slots with characters and, you know, it will deduct the coins immediately.
That's awesome.
Yeah, instead of doing that one by one and like having them introduced to you and everything, like that got old.
Yeah, it's pretty tedious when you're like, yeah, these aren't even real people. Why do I have to greet them?
Exactly. So that's a good improvement. And I'm sure there's some other stuff in the background that I haven't noticed that they've improved as well, because it's a pretty big update. And then you have to actually download the new games if you buy them. So anyway.
Did you buy both?
I did buy both. So we've got Ultimate Angler, which is a fishing game.
Hold on. You're bearing the lead. Does the rabbit still sell them to you in a scary way?
Oh, yeah.
Well, that's scary. I mean, he's
kind of creepy.
Yeah, I just see that guy in the background. I'm like, stop staring at me, dude.
Hey, kids, I got some games for you.
And he's very disappointed when you don't buy, except in Europe, where they have laws that prevent rabbits from looking disappointed, apparently.
He gave me a discount because I had bought some of the games from last time.
Yeah, they're really cheap if you've bought the previous games. I think I got both of them
cheap if you've already given Nintendo your money.
Well, you know. So I've got them for a little bit over $8 Canadian, so I can only imagine how much that is in US dollars, probably. Like
it was $7 for me.
Oh, okay.
It was $4.99 for one game, or I could get both for only $2 more. And I wasn't really going to get the fishing game, but when I saw it was only $2 to add it on, I said, okay, what the hell.
That's how we get you, kids.
Yeah, so it's actually pretty good. I mean, I'm a ProPay fan. Ultimate Angler is made by ProPay. They also made... Well, I know, it's tough. But they also made a fishing game on the Wii called Fishing Resort. And it's extremely similar. It's the same mechanics, basically, except instead of waggling the nunchuck to mimic the reeling motion, this time you kind of just rotate the circle pad, or you can also use the touch screen and, you know, scratch it to hell like you did when you were playing Elite Beat Agents.
Episode 270 of RFN, by the way, covered Fishing Resort, reviewed by one James Jones.
Oh, really? Huh.
Yes.
I actually bought that game recently, but you more on that like in the future episode.
You know what, John? I wrote a review. That's significant enough to be proud of.
So did I, buddy. Spiderwick Chronicles. Face. Face.
So, Ultimate Angler. I've been asked by someone on Twitter if, this game looks relaxing. It's not really... I wouldn't say it's a relaxing game. Neither of the two games are really something that you can stop paying attention to. You know, unlike Flower Town or some of the other games, like, you can't just mash the A button and be done with it and go through your street passes. You really have to press A at the right moment to hook the fish in, and then you have to reel it in. And it's not like you wait for the fish for a long time. It takes maybe 5 seconds between the time when you cast your line and the time that it bites. It's very much... So it goes fast, but you have to pay attention. And it's really fun. The game looks great. I'm not sure if I'm just, you know, kind of still wowed by the new 3DS screen or what, but the scenery is really nice, and the 3D effects, like everything looks like a miniature, you know, diorama or something. And you've also got, like, you can put your catch, the fish that you catch in an aquarium, and that looks really cool. That looks in 3D.
Yeah. It's a good looking game for sure. The boat is. Looks really nice that you get on.
And if you don't get a lot of street passes, I think this is one of the better games to get, because you don't really need a ton of street passes per time that you play to get much out of it. Like, first, you can just use coins and pretty much get the same thing. You get bait from the people that you street pass based on their shirt color. And you get like 3 or 4 street passes and you're good to go. Like, you're going to be playing for maybe 5-8 minutes, and then you stop and you've managed to catch a few fish, and you know, you're probably pretty happy with it. And it's kind of the same thing with Battleground Z, which is this beat 'em up where there's this zombie invasion, and you happen to help the scientists develop a cure. So you're beating up these zombies and you're rescuing the people that you street pass in levels. And the people that you street pass give you a weapon based on the activity that they say they enjoy on their me profile. So if they say that they enjoy cooking, they're going to give you a frying pan and you're going to whack zombies with a frying pan. If they say that they like playing video games, well, they give you a Wii remote, and that kind of becomes a sword that you swing around. It's a very basic beat-em-up. I'm not sure if it's really... It's a good game. I mean, it's perfectly serviceable, but you're really getting a beat-em-up. They try to make it... to vary the action a little bit by giving you sometimes... by making you protect someone, like escort missions, or you're going to have to find certain supplies and explore a level and then get back to the person, and things like that. But mostly you're just mashing A until all the zombies are dead. Also, one of the other good features of the game, I think, is that it's really, really funny. At least when you discover a new weapon, it's really, really good. Like, they're really imaginative with the way that they, they transformed people's interests into weapons, and it's just cool to see. You know, like, if someone says that they like sleeping, then you just whack zombies with a pillow, and then if you do a charge attack, you've got this special attack where you just, you know, take a nap, and then sheep start coming out of you, and just like, you can basically direct them and bash zombies with them. It's I don't know, it's funny stuff. I think the one that I prefer so far is the dance one, because your Mii doesn't have feet, and yet you're supposed to be dancing. So he's just like gliding around and being fabulous. And, it's fantastic. So yeah, I enjoy them. I think that, you know, you probably bought them already if you were interested in them. Like, I think just by the descriptions, either you are interested or you're not. So, all I can say is that, you know, they're pretty good at what they do. They're well done. They look good. And they're a good way to spend a couple of minutes, you know, after getting a few street passes.
Yeah. That's all they're for.
Yep. And so
is it time?
Yeah, I guess so. Oh, but you really oversold
because now we have to have a fight.
I have played a little bit more of DK64. And I still haven't got to the part where the collectathon aspect of it becomes a problem, because, and this is going to sound weird, but when I play it, it makes me kind of physically, like, it brings me discomfort. Like, it gives me...
Vomit all over the N64.
Not vomit, but...
I'm playing on the virtual console, I find one to vomit on.
Yeah, it gives me a migraine. Like, it really, like, I become, I don't know if it's like some sort of claustrophobic attack, because the camera is so freaking close to your character and you don't see anything, you don't see where you're going, or if it's just like the frame rate that's giving me motion sickness, even though I don't really get motion sickness from games. But yeah, it's really like, I'm not gonna subject myself to this. because it just doesn't seem worth it. So I've got 4 golden bananas. I unlocked Diddy Kong. Very early, and the whole power up structure doesn't make any sense to me. Like, it says at some point, one character says, okay, well, once you unlock abilities for one Kong, it unlocks for all of them. And I'm like, okay, cool. And I'm Diddy Kong, and I'm coming up to a switch that you, I assume, trigger with a butt stomp and a move that DK himself has. Very early in the game, and I can't do it because apparently I don't have it. And usually it's Cranky Kong that gives you these moves, and I go to both of the huts, Cranky Kong huts that I've found, and in neither case he gives me that move. So I don't know what the game is expecting of me.
It's telling you that only...
Well, those pads, they aren't actually activated by a butt stomp. You just have to press the trigger. Like, you don't have to jump and press the trigger. The Z trigger. Well, whatever you map the Z trigger to. You just have to press that button. You don't have to jump.
Right. I thought I had tried that, and it didn't work. But maybe I was a little bit off. I don't know. Like, there's another sequence where I use kind of... Diddy got a charge attack, and I'm supposed to use it on 2 gongs. And then that made a barrel with a golden banana on it appear, but it's out of reach. So I assume
you have to unlock. I'm assuming you have to unlock Chunky Kong later in the game, and you have to get his power up to move the platform up.
See, so the game doesn't explain that, and it doesn't strike it as worth it to me. Like, I don't want to keep playing this, so I won't.
You know, that's kind of the contrast for me. I really like when games do that, where they kind of present you with just a vague kind of concept, and that's like part of the fun of why I like that game so much, is just figuring out what to do and where to go and how to unlock certain things.
In this game, I'm of two minds, because I like that they set up the levels in such a way that they expect you, and they mandate you come back with the other characters once you've unlocked them. I can understand where Guillaume is coming from, though, because he doesn't know about the other characters right now. He doesn't know what they're capable of, so he doesn't look at a scenario and go, oh, I can't do that one yet.
Right.
Yeah. So, like, why can't I do that one?
The game is showing me this. It must want me to do it. What the hell do I do?
Yeah, like, it already asked me to use the kind of the charge move for this banana to appear in the first place. Why would it require me to have another power-up to go get it? And I understand, like, it's not, the thing is, it's nothing that I haven't seen before. Like, I see that thing is out of reach. I think, okay, well, I'm going to get a higher jump or a double jump or something like that. Like, you know, like, it's not going to be like this super power up that's going to really change the way that I look at platformers. It's probably going to be something that I've seen before. And I have
not like
a higher.
You haven't seen Lanky Kong before.
Lanky is something.
Yeah, he's and one of the most I think characters. I have a higher tolerance for that kind of thing in 2D platformers, because everything is immediately visible. Everything is recognizable. Like, I can look at the level and know already, like, okay, I can't make that jump. It's very clear. I come short. And at some point, I'm going to get something that's going to allow me to make that jump. In 3D, it's not immediately as obvious, and also the fact that there might be stuff like behind the camera, or, you know, I don't know, it's really annoying. And the camera, like, way zoomed in all the time. I keep having to pull it back, and it's really not cooperative. And you know, I've seen some people when Super Mario Galaxy came out complain that, you know, they couldn't control the camera and they really missed it. And I would often come to Galaxy's defense and say, well, you know, like, the Wii Remote doesn't really have that many buttons. And also, you know, Grandma or Little Timmy can't necessarily get into 3D platformers where you also control the camera. It's a big obstacle.
Little Timmy, yeah. Now, for Little Mario Timmy Galaxy, needs to get good.
No, but I have to come clean now. I think that really I don't care about Grandma or Timmy. I can't deal with camera controls. I need a fully automated camera, and I don't think I can go back to that.
In the case of Mario Galaxy, I feel like you almost never really need to control a camera in the first place, because I think it does kind of a really good job on
it. Well, I mean,
that
game is sort of stealth linear in a lot of ways. Like,
Absolutely.
It looks like
it's not stealth linear. It's way too linear for my taste a lot of times.
Yeah, I mean, there are places where it sort of hides the linearity by letting you move around an area, but the area itself is actually in a line.
Yeah, I think that that's mainly, like, most of those levels in Mario Galaxy are super linear, but when the only time I feel like I would need to control the camera are the ones where they give you the illusion of it just kind of being an open area. So
Yeah.
Well, like Throwback World, which is just an N64 level. And then all of a sudden you're like, oh shit, I can't control the camera here.
Well, they do give you some control.
But, yeah, but not to the degree that you had when that level was originally designed.
No, not like in a game like Mario Sunshine, where you actually had like complete Wind Waker style control, and basically the environments in the game were so complicated that you had to constantly manage the camera as you played through the game, and it often would kind of try to take over the camera for you, and you'd have to like fight against the game
because
it has some scripted angle that it wanted to shift to.
Well, let me show you this. Let me show you this. No.
I don't want to look at it.
Yeah. In that way, it was a different camera than Wind Waker, because the Wind Waker one would stay put. The Sunshine one would hide to fight it a lot. But yeah, in Donkey Kong, it seems like it's never where I want it to be.
Yeah, that's one big thing that I can admit Donkey Kong 64 for being garbage in places is that camera.
The coins is where it's garbage. But yes, the camera's not great either.
Yeah. I mean, for
the most part, you are a real big fan, aren't you?
Oh, absolutely. Like, I can admit that the game is garbage in most places, but
wow. I don't think it's terrible though. I mean, it kind of drills some concepts into the ground, I think, is the problem.
Maybe calling it garbage for the most part is a bit harsh.
I would look at this game as a situation where Rare needed somebody to come in from the outside and go, guys, what the fuck are you doing?
Yeah, maybe. But all in all,
I think
still...
it was rushed.
Maybe. I don't know. I still really enjoyed it back when it first came out, and I'm playing it again on the Virtual Console, and I still enjoy it to a point, but yeah, some of those issues are becoming way more apparent as to why people dislike this game.
So I mean, Virtual Console question, because I mean, I enjoyed this game well enough when it came out, although even I was going, you know, I was still pretty young going, all right, game, you need to get your shit together. But, like, does this game perform significantly better on the Virtual Console? Because on the N64,
absolutely.
It was a goddamn mess.
Absolutely. It actually performs really well. I was actually kind of surprised that it was able to run, like, better than it was on the N64. Because, from what I've heard, it always had problems running on, like, computer emulators. And I just never really expected it to be re-released because of all those issues. But as far as I've played it, the frame rate has been really steady. It actually runs faster, slightly faster than it did on the N64, because I played that game so much as a teen that I can beat for beat remember where certain sound effects pop in and where the music ends and stuff, and I could see, and I could hear, like, you know, certain cutscenes ending or certain, like, musical indentations ending, like, earlier when it originally was on the N64, and I can notice that it just runs faster.
Oh, so the video is able to better sync with the audio.
Exactly, yeah.
Because this game used MP3s, because it was using the... What was the name of that codec that they had on the... Damn it, I can't remember. But that,
ADX?
Yeah.
No.
So this was syncing in-game rendered video to MP3s, which Rare found, and it comes up again in Conquer and stuff, that if you do that and the game slows down, the audio gets out of sync.
Mm-hmm. But audio is definitely one of the high points of this game, especially in that infamous introduction.
infamous.
Mm-hmm.
Speaking of, John, have you ever played past the first 5 minutes of this game?
I have played deep into this game. I think I owned this.
John, have you wrapped the first 5 minutes of this game?
I definitely have done that. I have done that.
As everyone
heard
at the end of last week's episode, yes, John has definitely done that.
Yeah. No, I've played, I owned this. So I don't know if I've beaten this. I think I might have beaten it though, because this was, at the time, I was a huge fan of all the Rare platformers. Like, I had them all. Banjo-Kazooie, Banjo-Kazooie, Banjo-Tooie, I had them all.
Fun fact.
Yeah, maybe that's why I like this game so much, because I never played Banjo-Kazooie when it first came out. So I had nothing really to compare it to other than like Mario 64, and to me, just having everything so expansive and just having little secrets here and there was just made such an impression on me. And I just thought the entire adventure was incredible.
So, yeah, I mean, this wasn't terrible by any means. It was just kind of more of the same, and then a ton of, you know, find this stuff, find that stuff sprinkled on top.
To me, yeah, the bananas is a pain in the butt when you have to collect all the different Kong's bananas.
That can be annoying.
There are two things in the game at the very end to get the ending. We have to get these coins. I don't want to spoil them too badly, but I'm curious. One of them involves the original Donkey Kong, so that one's fine. Mm-hmm. But one of them involves an old Rare game, Jetpack.
Right.
Because, like all of Rare's games on the N64, it's full of self-referential stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm curious how they handle that here, because Nintendo doesn't own the rights to Jetpack anymore.
Well, I haven't gotten to that part in the game, but I've seen a few posts on Miiverse, and that game is just fully intact.
Oh,
they didn't change it at all.
Okay.
I mean, it was an NES game.
It was originally
It was like on the Spectrum or something.
Jetpack was like some old PC game.
It was ported to Amstrad, I believe, and I think it was also ported to the BBC Micro.
So it wasn't on NES.
It probably was at one point, but I mean, it was part of the UK games industry, so it showed up on all those weird home computers that sort of dominated that industry in that time.
I remember being excited to play Jetpack because I'd read about it probably in Nintendo Power at the time. And I knew it was – or no, I was probably reading it on IGN at the time. And I remember finding it in that arcade, which is pretty late in the game of Donkey Kong 64. And I remember playing Jetpack and finding that it was piss easy. Which is crazy to me because I thought maybe it was connected to Solar Jetman, which is an NES game made by Rare that is hard as hell, like one of the hardest video games ever. And Jetpack is, I mean, much simpler, but also just like...
It's also much older.
Yeah, it's definitely an old, primitive game.
I mean, it is in the Jetman series.
Crazy, crazy easy, which seemed weird to me, definitely.
Oh, I nailed it. ZX, BBC Micro, and the Commodore VIC-20. Yeah!
Well done. Well, Curtis, I'm glad that you're able to – I'm glad you can see some of the flaws. I'm glad you're not just so crazy that you can't see the game for what it is, but I'm also glad that you are still enjoying it and that you like it. I enjoyed DK64. It wasn't my favorite game or anything, but I enjoyed playing through it at the time. And then I think it's the only one of those – 3D platformers on N64 that I never, ever, ever had any wish to go back to ever again. I played it a couple years ago at PAX East. I saw it in the retro room, and I played it for about 2 minutes and said, "This is terrible. I never want to touch this again." Like that, even that alone was enough to kind of soil my memories of it to some extent. I was listening today to last week's episode of IGN's Nintendo Voice Chat podcast, and I think it was Marty Sliva on there, actually recommended that people go play Donkey Kong 64 on Virtual Console because it will make you appreciate all of the other 3D platformers so much more.
Yeah, I was recommending against Yoshi's New Island a couple of episodes ago, and I went back to it, and it feels great. Like, I'm like, this is a fun 2D platformer.
DK64 does its job. I mean, like, it's a shame that, as near as we can tell, we're never going to be able to get Banjo-Kazooie on the Virtual Console. Because that game is...
It's a much better game. Shame.
I actually played the Xbox 360 remade version of Banjo-Kazooie, probably about a few years ago, and
yeah,
I really, really, really liked it.
Check out Tui?
I played a little bit of Tui, and I wasn't a huge fan of it because I just went straight from Banjo-Kazooie to Tui, and there was a lot of things that I kind of missed about the first Banjo-Kazooie that just weren't there. But I want to go back to it someday, and it makes me sad that... Because I wish they would have re-released Donkey Kong 64... in that kind of style of like an HD remake of it, where they kind of fixed some of the little problems that it had, like especially the camera. Controlling the camera in DK64 on the VC is weird because that game was built with the N64 controller in mind, and that didn't have a second analog right. stick to control the camera. Those are just physical buttons that you need to press. Now, mm-hmm. while you can remap those C buttons to physical buttons, I'm still just, by just default, I'm just using the camera stick to control the camera, and pressing each little direction one by one is so weird and foreign to me that I just kind of wish there was better control with that. Like,
It's probably Rare's. It's probably a Retro Studios' next big project is to remake Donkey Kong 64 for the 3DS.
No, it'll be Monster. Oh. They're the ones doing all the remakes.
DK 64 returns.
But that would be really cool if they, you know, kind of revisited that style, but just like kind of got rid of more of the tedious stuff about that game, because I feel like there's a lot of really cool things in that game to explore and to find out. And that's like one of the big reasons why I enjoy it so much, because there was just a lot to explore. And I loved going back to every little crevice and seeing what I can do now that I have this new Kong or this new ability. Mm. And it's just like, oh yeah, I can go back there and use a little twirly thing. Oh, I can shrink down here now. Oh, awesome. And I get to see all these new little areas. And
oh,
you know, to me, that's just kind of rewarding.
Kong. Oh boy.
Oh yeah, Lanky Kong's the best part. What are you kidding? No,
oh my God.
Lanky is definitely the best part. I think the redemption for this genre may be on the horizon. I mean, we've talked about the joke / rumor / maybe next project of Yacht Club Games. They've talked about Shovel Knight 64 as being kind of something that they would love to do.
Ooh,
and I think actually, after having played a lot of Shovel Knight, I would really like to see that. That is a chance for them to dip back into this style and address all of the problems and kind of take all those lessons that we learned from the 90s and the early 2000s and make something similar but way better and really awesome. I would love to see that. But there's also the Banjo-Kazooie spiritual successor, supposedly from Playtonic Games.
Yeah, Project Ukulele, which Nick Bray for Nintendo World Report did an interview with those guys on, asking them about both Project Ukulele as well as some other their other experiences with game development in that era of specifically of Rare games. It's a like they did a live stream a couple weeks ago at this point where they talk about like DK64 in particular, that if you can find it's interesting for this topic. But Nick actually had I think it's Gavin Price, who is the creative lead, discuss both, you know, both what they're planning for this new game and what they're, you know, how they are using their experiences from these games of the late 90s to create this spiritual successor that feels like it's moved forward, as it were.
Hmm. I think that game is supposed to be fully revealed here really soon.
Yeah.
Like a couple of weeks maybe, before E3, I'm pretty sure.
It's
going to be on a magazine cover, right? Edge Game Informer.
It'll almost certainly be one of the European ones like Edge.
Yeah.
So Edge. One thing that they did mention in a very Rare sort of way when they were talking about this game was they want to have a big cast of characters, but you really just play as these two. And then they can flesh out the other characters in future games. I'm like, first off, you guys are way too ambitious. Secondly, you guys spent way too much time at Rare.
All right. Well, let's wrap up new business. We'll take a quick break. You'll hear some more Now Playing in addition to what we just did. And when we come back, we'll have some listener mail.
Now Playing is taking over.
Now Playing, a sampling of the best new original content at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we wanted to remind you of the interview with Playtonic Games by Nick Bray, with assistance from Michael T.Y.P. Cole. Nick sits down with these ex-Rareware developers and talks to them about Project Ukulele, their spiritual successor to Banjo-Kazooie. Nick asks the hard-hitting questions like, is there a talking toilet? And how many objects have googly eyes? And how long before you tell us it's only for PS4 and Xbox? That's harsh. That's dropping some harsh reality.
I prefer acerbic.
I'll take it. We also have impressions, Mewtwo in Super Smash Bros. By Justin Berube. Mr. Omega Final Destination No Items himself takes Mewtwo for a spin and gives his take on the new character's strengths and weaknesses. I've already passed this over to John so he can stop embarrassing himself week after week.
Just a couple system pointers for me. You know what I mean?
We're done. Mm-hmm. Is that a spoiler? We're done, but fuck it, we're done. I don't care.
Yep.
We lost. Guess what? We lost to a team that goes No Items Final Destination.
Yep.
Figure.
Yep. All right, and we got a round table on the Smash ballot. Who did each staff member pick for their Smash Brothers vote? More importantly, how many times did Neil vote for Brett Favre? He has bad intentions.
Oh, no. Oh. I personally voted for the crew from Wrecking Crew, not pictured.
Hmm. Anyways. And we also have a preview of Puzzle & Dragons Super Mario Bros. Edition for 3DS by Don Koopman. Who better to play a pseudo-smartphone game than Don, who plays games of smartphone quality week after week? He gives his impression of this immensely popular title and why Mario fans might want to pick it up.
All this and actually not more Don depression. We're pretty clear on Don this week. But more content is available to you at NintendoWorldReport.com.
Welcome back, everyone. It is time for listener mail. As always, the address, and someone asks me almost every single week, the email address to get your email on the show is RFN, just like Radio Free Nintendo, RFN.
That's what it stands for.
At NintendoWorldReport.com. NintendoWorldReport.com. It rolls right off the tongue. Curtis, would you please read this lengthy and fascinating first email?
Sure thing. All right. Sam from Finland writes, "Howdy. A lot of people seem irritated about the introduction of the DS into the Wii U's virtual console, as they were with the GBA. Handheld games are best suited for handhelds, and so on. Personally, I think that's an oversimplification that doesn't really add much to the conversation. Whether or not a handheld game natural home is on a handheld depends entirely on the game in question. The Japanese market is especially awash with home console-like experiences on portables, because that's where gamers are these days. That most of Nintendo's games work great on handhelds seemed to be more of the result of the kinds of games they tend to make than anything else, emphasizing accessibility and visual clarity over complex game mechanics and graphical spectacle. Nintendo's best third-party GBA games especially, like the Metroids, Fire Emblems, Advance Wars, Minish Cap, etc., feel like a lost late-gen SNES titles, and I thoroughly enjoyed playing them as such on my big-screen TV. Is the resolution slow? Sure, but so is that of the NES, and no one complains about that. And what about their 3DS games? What kind of design choices did they make with their major titles to adapt them to the handheld environment? Fire Emblem Awakening, A Link Between Worlds, Super Mario Land 3D, Mario Kart 7, etc. play pretty much exactly like their counterparts do on consoles, while games like Luigi's Mansion Dark Moon and Kid Icarus Uprising would have actually worked better as console titles considering their inflexible save systems and marathon-long mission structure. And I haven't even mentioned all the N64 remasters. Now, admittedly, if you look at their Nintendo DS catalog, things are a bit different. Games like WarioWare Touched and Yoshi's Touch and Go are actually a lot like modern smartphone games, and do work best on the handhelds. Still, I appreciated the opportunity to try Touched on my Wii U, and will appreciate inevitable future releases like Order of Ecclesia, Advance Wars Days of Ruin, and all the RPGs that work great as home console experiences. I don't have a long commute, so the portability does not add much to the experience anyway. It's not like going through the trouble of emulating those games on the Wii U is a loss for the 3DS anyway. If Nintendo decided to re-release DS games on the 3DS eShop, it would not be through emulation, but the 3DS's backwards compatibility. That's how they released Advance Wars Days of Ruin in Japan. Anyway, thanks for the great show, and sorry about the long email. I'll try to be more concise next time.
Always good to hear from Greg Leahy's alt account.
No need to be concise. We'll just read the whole damn thing.
It's such a great email. I mean, it really breaks it down, and I don't necessarily agree with every point along that path, but I think it's an incredibly well-made argument, and there's a lot to agree with there.
Yeah, well,
I still wish these games came out on 3DS. Though.
First he talks about first he talks about like GBA games and how they felt like long lost 16-bit titles. So those kind of translate well to the Wii U. They translate well to a console. It's like playing, you know, slightly worse SNES, and you know, but with
greatly
newer games.
Worse in some cases.
Yeah.
And keep in mind, a lot of GBA games were designed knowing that people would play them on a TV because the Game Boy Player was a concurrent device.
It was an SD device though. That's a big difference. So it wasn't made to play on an HD set. But they still
blew the games up really big. But now you're blowing them up
by a factor of two beyond that. I mean, it's noticeable. It's very noticeable on a GBA game on your TV. On an HD set.
Well, still, I wanted to make the point that a lot of GBA games were designed with the TV in mind. The fact that they could be played on a TV because Game Boy Player was released for GameCube while GBA games were still coming out.
Yeah.
It was a concurrent device. Mm-hmm. And there were games that, we used to interview people and they would talk about this stuff. They would talk about trying to make sure that the color palette would look good both on the GBA original screen and the SP screen and on the TV. And some of those games even have options in the menu where you can set. And there's even a TV graphics option in the setting for this handheld game. And those would be, it'd be really interesting to compare all three of them on the Wii U. Cause I'm sure the emulation alters or smears over some of the benefits and pros and cons of those different settings.
Yeah. Well, the Game Boy Player was not perfect either. I think a lot of people had problems with the resolution and the way that it would handle, resizing of the pixels. I'm not sure. I don't remember the details exactly, but I know there were maybe like two options, like kind of smoothed a little bit and not, and neither of them are really great.
Yeah, there was normal, there was smooth, and there was sharp. And right. I usually pick the sharp option. I actually picked up another Game Boy Player fairly recently, and I was kind of surprised at how good some of those games actually still look. Like, I have a S video cable and it looks way better than it does on composite. Cause Lord knows I can't find a GameCube component cable for under $250.
I used to have one.
I probably
lost it in the flood.
Yeah.
Of course.
I think ultimately what we're not arguing here is that, oh no, this GBA game should never come out on Wii U. My argument has always been, They have much less value to me on the Wii U than they do on the 3DS.
Yeah.
Like, these games, regardless of whether or not they feel like Super Nintendo games, they were designed as handheld games. And this is where I like to play them personally, but this is where they have the most value to me as an experience, because this is where I kind of need the backup. Like, this is, having a game on my 3DS on the go was actually super useful to me. I mean, I have no issue if Nintendo wants to put out Super Nintendo games on Wii U. Go nuts. But they should be putting them out on 3DS as well. Like, this is about serving your customer base, and your customer base is accustomed to these being handheld games. Like, you can do the
Super Nintendo stuff. I mean, Super Nintendo games have never been available on handheld before. 3DS.
No, I know. I'm talking about GBA games though. Like,
In that sector alone, I think there's a ton of potential for them to do Super Nintendo games on the 3DS.
Sure,
but
absolutely.
Wait, does it even do Super Nintendo? I know it does NES.
No, it doesn't.
But there's been kind of hints.
And that would be tremendous. If you could download ActRaiser and take it around on your 3DS,
that would be awesome. Yeah.
Name one of a thousand examples.
Sure.
Man, that would be awesome.
Are you looking at an alphabetized list of Super Nintendo games? If they did that, they said both platforms are getting what we can give them. Like, this whole, we would never have this conversation again. I get that the 3DS probably can't do N64 games. Fine. Whatever. But, like, if they're giving me GBA, which we know it can do, DS games, even if it's not as a virtual console, even if it is just, hey, you can download this game, but we'll just have it hot jump into the game. Fine. Whatever.
That's perfectly fine.
That's fine.
Yeah, I would have liked it if they did that, but I think, that's, like, their main kind of priority is to give them as many features as they possibly can. And it's probably easier to emulate GBA games and DS games on the Wii U than it is on the 3DS.
Sure, but I mean, you can repackage a DS game as essentially a DSi game and then put it out there as a DSi workshop.
But it'll probably take a lot more work to do that, and you know, knowing Nintendo.
They don't want to put that much work into VC stuff. Do their own freaking games, man.
They can at least do Picross 3D. For the children.
Exactly. Children love Picross.
They could at least do... Any number of these games that they've made guys, just give us something.
I'm just saying, I believe the children are our future.
I think we should teach them well and let them lead the
Thanks,
way.
Thanks, Pele.
Okay, well...
I kind of feel like we're thinking about this more than Nintendo have themselves sometimes.
Yeah, that's normal. Welcome to every episode of RFN, Guillaume.
Yeah, today it came out, an interview with Natsume about their virtual console output, and the info came out that Nintendo approaches them, tells them, these are the titles of yours that we're interested in releasing, and then they go emulate them, and they put that on their service. And
that doesn't sound like a real great setup.
It doesn't. Yeah. And also, it sounds like the Natsume representative was saying that, well, they're not really interested in any of our other SNES games right now. You know, which is especially frustrating because Natsume had been teasing Lufia 2 for a while, and that never came out. But, so Nintendo apparently is not really interested in the Super Nintendo and NES as platforms anymore, and they've kind of moved on. They've moved on to other things.
I mean, can you blame them? They need all that room for games like Don't Touch Anything Red.
They need that room for Wii games that they are not releasing. I don't get it. Like, come on. Like, if you put GBA games on the Wii U Virtual Console, fine. But actually put out your games. They've been sitting on Zero Mission in North America for God knows how long. And it's the same thing with Wii titles. Wii titles have come out in other regions. In North America, like, we don't even hear anything about it. They're not talking about it.
It's such a shame, too, and it's not, like, the first time this has happened. Like, even back in the Wii days, they would hype up the fact that Commodore 64 games were coming and arcade games were coming. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we would get, like, a few weeks of those games and just nothing else.
Yeah,
we talked about that recently, about why that might be the case.
Black Tiger.
It's just interesting because I feel like Nintendo fans look at it like this should be a way to curate all of this back catalog, but Nintendo looks at it like, okay, can this make us money? Okay, well, there's stuff that we obviously will release because it will make money for us.
Right.
If it won't, we don't care about it, and we'll try this experimental stuff, but if it tanks, fuck it, we're done with it.
Yeah, like...
It's
like
very profit-driven, it seems.
That's what makes games like... Which Ogre Battle sense, 64, but... which came out. Both Ogre Battles came out in the Virtual Console. It's like, what? Why?
Exactly.
What motivated you people to put out these games? Of all of the games you had, these two.
Well, also, thanks, but
like, what the fuck?
Yeah, if this is based entirely on market potential, I think you added an extra zero in your calculation, you know, for Ogre Battle on
like
Super Nintendo.
Like, you picked a game with crazy unsecured rights owned by multiple companies through acquisitions, and also a game that emulates poorly and said, yeah, this one.
Yeah, well, actually, the truth is we have no idea what's driving their decisions, because as you guys are pointing out, it doesn't even make sense. If they're looking at purely the profit factor, it doesn't make sense.
And especially since we get games like Crash and the Boys Street Challenge and Brawl Brothers on the
Jesus.
Virtual Console.
Yeah, I mean
did Nintendo ask for those games?
Apparently.
Who's nostalgic for that stuff? I don't get it. But Guillaume, I do want to point out that you characterized in your own way. I think you were kind of paraphrasing this Q&A, this FAQ with the Natsume person. But I read it today because I had heard some scuttlebutt and I was curious about what they actually said. And the way I read it, it seemed like their observation of what Nintendo's doing with Virtual Console, and not necessarily like inside information. Like, well, Nintendo told us that they don't care about Super Nintendo games anymore. To me, it looked more like an observation of, it just seems like they're not really releasing those. They've moved on to other things. I don't think Natsume, a company that literally works with Nintendo to release games, understands how this stuff is done. I don't think they get it either.
Yeah, I can tell you. I can tell you.
That says volumes.
I can tell you from conversations we've had at like events like E3 that at least a little bit of what Natsume is saying is not correct based on what other people have told us. So, yeah, I think it's entirely based on the interpretation they're getting from their interaction with Nintendo. It may not be reflective of what other companies are experiencing.
That's exactly it, right? That indicates that probably some companies probably could request stuff, and some are just like, don't call us, we'll call you.
Mm-hmm. It just doesn't seem like there's any kind of standardized thing. We had Dan Edelman on here and asked him about it. And he said, well, I wasn't involved with it. But also he said, I honestly don't know anything about it. I mean, he told us he doesn't know how stuff is selected for Virtual Console or how it gets out there.
This guy
basically ran the Wii Shop channel.
I mean, that tells you it's being run out of Kyoto, is what that tells you.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Yep. Which is why, you know, there was a tweet campaign started today, and I chipped my hat into it for people tweeting at Nintendo of America to say, hey, we want Lufia 2. If you guys, you know, but exactly. I mean, the Natsume guy says in English, hey, you know, Nintendo didn't seem interested when we kind of brought it up to them. That doesn't mean Nintendo of America turned it down. Nintendo of America probably doesn't even know what the fuck Nintendo was talking to Natsume about.
It's entirely possible they're talking to the wrong Nintendo. They could have been talking to the Nintendo of America rep. And Nintendo of America's like, that's great. We have nothing to say here because that decision's made 4,000 miles away.
Mm-hmm. We're sorry, but you've reached the wrong Nintendo.
Exactly. Hold on. Let me give you a number of somebody who you can't speak to.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. They're the person you need to speak to.
That's right.
If you want to get this stuff done.
Yeah, and
anyway,
I mean,
it could be some kind of
old boys network stuff too, where somebody says, "Hey, you know,
Natsume is one of the oldest boys."
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
Yeah, it's
we're peering into the abyss, is what we're doing right here.
Yeah, it's really weird.
Yeah, I mean, it's just a black hole.
We've been talking about the same thing. We come to the same conclusion that we don't
like
know what the hell's
years.
Going on in the Virtual Console. Never. It's great.
Try twice as long as 4 years. We've been talking about this stuff since this show was created.
Yes.
In 2006, when Virtual Console was a brand new thing. Mm-hmm. And we're all like, how do they select these games? It doesn't seem to make a whole lot of sense.
But it's amazing because there's like
15
coming out a week.
Why did they go down to only two games a week?
Yeah.
back in those days.
Why is Black Tiger coming out? And also the game that's just using the Black Tiger engine with new graphics. What's happening here?
Yeah. Why is Capcom releasing three different versions of Street Fighter on the same day?
Yeah, yeah. Capcom really owned Virtual Console in a way that is just comedy. Like, you're just like, what the fuck is happening?
Who's asking for the Game Boy Color version of Rayman?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh my god. Oh, is that? Oh, why?
Totally random.
That is definitely up there. Okay, well, let's move on. And John Lindemann, please read the next email.
All right, TK writes, ever since Story of Seasons came out last month, I have been playing it constantly. The Harvest Moon series has always been a guilty pleasure of mine, and I rarely actually admit to being a hardcore fan, aside from on this podcast, apparently.
You do.
Normally, when I do try to explain the game to someone, they respond, oh, like Farmville, and my integrity as a gamer becomes compromised. As well it should. What are your guilty pleasure games, and why are you so embarrassed by them, James?
There's a nice transition here from Natsume to this, because as we've talked about on the show, Story of Seasons is the Harvest Moon games. It's just now Xseed has the rights because of their acquisition by Marvelous.
Yeah, and John can't get enough of these Harvest Moon
games. That's
right.
John has said during now playing,
yep.
he had some hay fever or something. I don't know what was going on, but
I'm a weird junkie.
That was definitely him playing
Hook
the game.
Hook me up.
Right,
John,
your
you're
veins.
Not getting this confused with European Farm Simulator 2015, are you?
Doesn't really matter. I play them all.
Yes, so guilty pleasures. I mean, I basically air them on this show at this point. Like, it's just I'll talk about playing Conception 2 on a podcast. Fuck it, I don't care.
You don't really seem that guilty about it, and nor do I think you should be. My answer to this is I can't think of anything. I feel like you should own up to whatever it is that you like and don't feel guilty about it. Don't let other people make you feel guilty about it. I mean, you know, that's why I used to talk about Magic the Gathering and you guys all laughed at me. I'm like, fuck you, I like it.
Yeah, I mean, it could also be interpreted as a game that you just know is crap, but you love anyways.
Well, the...
Right?
The I don't know. I guess the times when I feel self-conscious when I'm playing is mostly when I'm playing like really senselessly violent stuff, or which is not very often because I mostly play Nintendo games, but yeah, or like really sexualized stuff, or you know, because Karen is around, like I feel more self-conscious about it, although I never it's never been, you know, a component that I really enjoyed in those games. Like I've always rolled my eyes at the God of War sex mini games, which are stupid, which are as funny. It's funny in a way, but at the same time, like why do we need this? You know,
man's like, gotta do what like, a man's gotta do. I mean,
it's like something out of South Park. I mean, it's so
juvenile. I was just like, you know, I made sure I got all the coins or whatever you could get out of it. All the, you know, but you know,
yeah,
that's more of a gameplay conceit than anything else.
I had
to
get that platinum trophy, and that requires me dig a little gold.
In certain cases, like in Saints Row, when I'm not really enjoying the game that much anyway, that might lead me to stop playing the game a little bit earlier. But in other cases, like in Bayonetta, where I'm actually really enjoying the game, and I played through it several times, and Karen probably got really tired of it, but it led to some, you know, interesting conversations about the, I don't know, I guess the not the virtues. It's not the right word at all.
Discuss the art design.
I disagree.
And the choices
there.
Those
are entirely.
No, but more like her merits as a character, you know?
Yeah.
It's interesting.
Mm-hmm. So, aside from obviously DK64, as we were discussing earlier, you know what?
Gemini.
You know what? I actually really liked The Simpsons Road Rage on the GameCube.
Wait, which one? Is that the Crazy Taxi one?
That's the Crazy Taxi ripoff.
Well, that was actually really good, wasn't it?
Because there's two Simpsons driving games like a year apart.
Really. I mean, I enjoyed
it. There were two Simpsons driving games a year apart.
There was one Simpsons game that was really good.
You're thinking of Hit and Run.
That was Simpsons Hit and Run.
Yeah, okay. Yep.
Yeah, Simpsons Road Rage was on GameCube.
How could you confuse Road Rage with Hit and Run? They're completely different things.
Yeah, seriously.
They came out 13 months apart, people. Come on.
Road Rage was a Crazy Taxi ripoff that was on GameCube, Xbox, PS2. Yeah, it's a blatant ripoff of Crazy Taxi.
Oh, yeah, there was a lawsuit.
And oh, really?
They lost. Yeah, they lost. They got
sued. Oh, I had no idea.
Yeah.
But that was a game I really enjoyed just for the fact that I got to drive around Springfield and it was fully voice acted, and you know, it was just a lot of fun to, you know, explore that town, even though it had really bad graphics and really, really bad load times.
And but, it was non-canon.
Exactly, yeah. I mean, that's the
non-canon most important part. Simpson, yes.
Yeah. And, a lot of
it
those...
It broke the timeline, just killed it.
Yeah, a lot of those games in that era, in that generation of games, I feel like have the most guilty pleasures of mine. Another one was, I don't know if you guys remember a series called there was Outlaw Golf, Outlaw Volleyball.
Oh yeah,
sure. Yeah. Sure.
Voiced by Stephen Colbert.
Yeah, Stephen Colbert, Dave Attell, they were like announcers for those games. Yeah, I really like those Outlaw games. Even though they were really, really immature and trashy, but you know, I 15, 16 year old me was still laughing at those.
The character.
Actually, no, I was older at that point. I was around 18 or 19.
The character list in Outlaw Golf is, it's a trip. Mm-hmm. Summer, a scientist / stripper.
Yeah.
Of course.
Ice Tray, a failed rapper. Harley, a biker with a good swing.
That's exactly the kind of stuff that I was talking about when we discussed Geist, and that generation in general is just... embarrassing. It's embarrassing.
El Suave, man's man with great hair.
What was this from? 2002. Yeah, this was when Limp Bizkit was popular and Fred Durst was
I'm surprised they didn't make
the soundtrack
to this game.
Shout out to our NeoGAF friends who did the pleasure of linking me a Fred Durst intro from a wrestling game about 2000.
Are we sure they didn't do the soundtrack to this game?
Oh god, they're probably on the soundtrack somewhere, Limp Bizkit. That was a very attitude-y time.
Yeah,
everything was
so Fred Durst was totally in a video game as a follow-up to Hits the Road discussion.
Yeah, he was actually a wrestling character in WWF, I don't know, whatever game came out
Royal Rumble, I don't know what the hell it was. It was like No Mercy or something. I don't know. Yeah.
It's back in the early 2000s.
God damn it.
This is probably also the time period that birthed our favorite BMX Triple X.
Yeah.
Which would be, for me, the guilty pleasure game, because that game
We had fun playing that game. It's not a good game, nor is it fun.
It's not good.
There's just moments where the game is so bad in every conceivable way. It looks terrible. It was controlling god-awful. The camera's just gone to do its own thing.
It's just a bad idea. What
it's asking you to do at this moment, take the strippers to scores, it's just like, you're just like, I don't...
It's so terrible. I mean, the thing is, it's a game that it can't even... It can't even execute on its flawed premise.
Yeah,
well.
And you sit there going like, "This is real. I'm alive right now. Yeah. I'm alive in the year of our Lord 2014, playing this game."
Yeah, but unless you play this regularly, I don't think it counts as a guilty pleasure. It's more, you know, like we got together and we made fun of it.
I dig up games like this and play them.
Don't judge my pleasure, Guillaume.
I feel like we've gotten pretty far away from the intent of the original question. If you look back at the context of TK's email, this was about a game that if someone saw you playing it, they would think you're not a hardcore gamer. I can't really think of anything I play that I would, not that I would be concerned about that anyway, because I don't really give a shit if
anybody thinks.
I would probably relate that to the Outlaw games I was talking about.
Yeah, okay.
I would be ashamed if people saw me playing those and enjoying those.
I think they probably carry like the dude bro. Like,
yeah.
Oh, what are you, an Xbox dude, bro?
Yeah, like we only play Wii during beer pong breaks or something like that, you know.
What was that one game where it had like this live action intro about they're like snowboarders or skiers in a cabin?
The
main guy asked, "What if it snowed in San Francisco?"
Yeah, that's damn it.
Oh, what was that game?
What is that, like SSX or something? Or
no, it wasn't SSX. It
had somebody's name on it too.
Yeah,
it was probably
Sean... Johnny Mosley Matrix. Yes. Yes.
Okay,
you win the episode, James.
Holy
crap!
Wow.
To the next email.
Yeah, really. Yeah. Let's move on.
Yes.
Christ, Johnny Mosley. God, you're a savant.
James,
what
would
if
you
it snowed
read...
in San Francisco? Yeah, James. Yeah.
Johnny Mosley.
James, would you please read the last email?
I don't know Johnny Mosley, Mike. Johnny Mosley Matrix writes.
What if it snowed in San Francisco?
Yeah. If we get that email now, I'm just going to lose it. Terrence writes, is Nintendo doing independent developers a disservice on the eShop? As noted, 95% of games in the top 20 list on the eShop are all first-party titles, the lone exception being Angry Video Game Nerd Adventures. The issue I have with the list is that lumping virtual console games with new games has to hurt the discoverability for independent games. Between the brand name, the nostalgia, and the low price, it's almost a given that Metroid Fusion would take money away from something like Teslagrad. Maybe it would be better to do a top 10 VC games while making only new retail plus eShop games eligible for the bestsellers list. Consumers can't buy what they can't see. And while the Wii U and 3DS eShops are way better than the old Wii Shop channel, it's little things like this that hurt the sales of non-Nintendo published games. Also, for the past few months, the bulk of the top 20 list on the eShop have been made up by whatever games have been given away on Club Nintendo. I know it might have been expensive in the short run, but would it not have been better for Nintendo in the long run to have made games like Shovel Knight, Guacamelee, etc. available for Club Nintendo coins? Almost like a mini PlayStation Plus. Pushing different types of games as a publisher opposed to their own classics might have actually led to healthier software ecosystem for Nintendo. Would love to hear your thoughts on the matter. Love the show.
Yeah, discoverability is always a huge problem. I mean, the thing is, with everything shifting over now to buying stuff online, you have more and more games out there. So what games get on the front page? No one wants to sort through a shit ton of games. So
the shitty part is all three platforms kind of have this issue.
Yeah,
sure.
Like four platforms,
if you include Steam.
Yeah, Steam.
Which you should. Steam's problem is just volume of fire. It's just so much garbage comes out every day. It's impossible to keep up.
Yep.
On the PS3 in the last gen, it was basically just here's all the games, here's a list, scroll through, have fun.
Yeah.
Whereas Microsoft basically they kept tweaking the shop. They changed it four or five times.
They tweaked it a lot, but they always kept indie stuff buried.
For good reason.
You could not find it. There was good indie games.
It was bad on the 360.
Yeah,
but I do think Terrence might be might be kind of undervaluing the presentation that Nintendo does on the Wii U eShop in particular.
Yeah.
I think they actually do a really good job of showcasing indie games. And if you boot up the eShop, if I did it right now, at least as of this recording, I'm pretty sure you'd see Affordable Space Adventures at the very top of the page. So I suppose Terrence is looking at the bestsellers list as the primary way that people would go there and find out what's for sale.
Yeah.
I'm sure that's true of some people, and I know that's kind of a typical way that that you hear about people doing it on the iTunes store or the App Store.
Yeah, it's basically the only way that you can find anything on those platforms.
Because
it's the Steam problem.
Well, the
but worse.
Steam is somewhat manicured. They tend to show you one game at a time on that front page of the Steam portal, which I think has its advantages. But on the App Store. For an iPhone, for instance, there really isn't like a front page that's like arranged, you know, headline style or to look like an e-commerce site. It's really kind of just lists. It's kind of organized by list. It doesn't guide you through. It doesn't say, hey, if you're in the mood for this kind of thing, check out this. If you're not, you know, check out this. I think the eShop actually does a much better job of guiding your eyes, explaining what the different kinds of games that are available. It says, here's a few suggestions, but also here's a bunch of categories where you can go and browse through long lists of whatever. Here's all the NES games.
Games for summer.
I think the eShop front page, now the rest of the shop, you know, maybe isn't as good, but I think that front page, especially on the Wii U, they've done a really good job with it, I think.
Yeah.
And they really do highlight.
For the most part, yeah, because there are some times where things kind of fall through the cracks as well. Like, he was mentioning in the email, specifically Angry Video Game Nerd Adventures. Now, that was a game that that came out, it was mentioned in the press release, but only as like a footnote to like also available this week, AVGN Adventures.
Right.
They didn't add a description or anything for it. They didn't even feature it on the front page of the eShop. They didn't even tweet about it.
And it's still in the top 20.
Yeah. And James Rolfe actually tweeted out, hey, to find this game, just search AVGN in the eShop. Cause there was no, like, there wasn't an option for recent releases in, you know, that front page update.
Weird.
So
it might have to do with the rating of
the
game.
Best game that came out that week.
I mean, the recent releases list doesn't always seem to be recent releases.
Yeah,
is this rated M by any chance?
I think it is.
Absolutely, it is.
So
if you played
that might
like
have a
one
lot
minute
to
of that
it.
Game,
but
yeah.
James, I'm not sure. I disagree. I usually find pretty much all the latest releases when I just go through the latest releases section.
I've noticed sometimes that the also available this week stuff doesn't always show up in there.
Hmm.
Or it won't show up in the dead order they came up in.
Okay.
And like you'll be like, oh, hey, this game's from last week. Oh, but there's the ones that were at the bottom. There's your Me and My Baby 2.
On the Wii U, I think also that the Virtual Console games don't draw attention to them all that much. Usually it's kind of like this weird smaller section where you can select different systems and then you go into that and you find the games. So I can't say
there's a big new release. Like I bet if you go over there right now, they're showcasing DK64.
Oh, probably
showcasing some of that DS stuff that they're putting out. You know, like during May when they do the Mega May thing,
There's
going to be a Mega Man on that front page. I mean,
no,
whatever is the most recent Virtual Console release, they'll have something about it on the front page.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. I feel like probably Nintendo is helping out these indie developers by putting out Virtual Console games, because that's usually what people tune in for. That's what they go visiting the eShop for, and then they see these games, and maybe they buy them, maybe they don't. There was, at a recent developers conference, there were slides shown where basically, like, what is selling and how much on the PSN and the Xbox shop, whatever, XBLA, and on the eShop. And it seemed to be that the stuff that sold the most on the eShop were ports, were stuff that you could find on the other systems. Why? Because those games got more publicity. And so I just don't think that. And, you know, and actually the eShop exclusives didn't sell as much unless they got a strong push from Nintendo. So I think that says that shows that people don't necessarily go to the eShop to go discover these games. They discover exactly. games first, and then they go hunt for them on the eShop.
Yes, exactly. And this is part, I think Nintendo's done a good job generally of using the eShop and promoting it, marketing it, making it easier to use, especially over the years. They've made a lot of improvements there, but there is a cultural inertia, I believe, to their fan base, to their, and not necessarily to the five of us or the people listening to this show, but the larger, you know, people, group of people who own Wii U's, which is already a small group, I think is largely not that interested in downloading games to their system. Hmm. And that's partly because Nintendo didn't advertise that stuff, didn't explain it very well
at didn't all put a hard drive.
Yep.
Right. There's no hard drive. So you never really have a great sense for how many games you can download. Maybe if you haven't really messed around with it, you think, I'm going to fill that up so fast. And hey, if you bought a white system in the beginning, you will, you know, like you literally can't even download stuff like Tropical Freeze.
Right.
It's not going to fit on, barely fits on a black system.
Here's one of the things that I was toying with in one of the aborted essays was the idea of Nintendo just as a way to promote some of these games that aren't getting run. Like if there's a game they feel is really important, and there are ones they do. So like a bunch of the Western only eShop, you know, games that are like the Swapper and stuff, they actually went and published those themselves in Japan. And they did quite well, actually. They sold very, very well in the Japanese eShop. But because of the weird publishing rules, like somebody had to do it. Nintendo really respected those games and said, fine, we'll just do it ourselves. And they got, I think it was 3 games. And my guess is based on the sales, they'll probably do more of them. But what they could do is if it's a game they think is really good, and this is something that I'm surprised they haven't done, is just push a demo to your system. As opposed to pushing an alert. It's already there. All you have to do is press it and start. And then at the end of the demo, it goes, you want to buy this? Yes or no? Because they already say, hey, can we push you ads? What if that ad is just something you can play versus just being a thing that chimes when you're in the other room and scares the crap out of you because you don't know what the hell that noise is?
Yeah, I mean, they've done it before with a couple of their own games. I think they did it for Wii Sports Resort.
But here's the thing. On the eShop, everything is their game because they get a cut for everything.
Yeah. I kind of wish.
Well, they get a cut for everything regardless. Even at retail, they get a cut.
Yeah, but
it's much bigger on eShop for sure. I mean, part of it is there just aren't that many demos. There aren't that many demos on the eShop.
But here's the thing. If Nintendo told a publisher, hey, or an indie dev, hey, we're going to push this demo to every Wii U that is connected to the internet that it has agreed to the system, and it defaults to yes, and afterwards they're going to be prompted, do you want to buy this? Do you think they would make a demo for that? I bet they would.
I bet they would, but creating a demo is a tall order for an independent
developer. It is.
Yeah, well,
but
be incentivizing it for sure.
On the 360, I don't know if it's the same on the Xbox One, but all the Xbox Live Arcade games, the demos were the full game. And
right,
after like a couple levels, they were saying, okay, the demo's done. Would you like to buy this game? And you can buy it and just instantly unlocks.
It was a smart way to do it, and
it sold them a lot of games. Yeah, that got me to buy a lot of games on this service.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, because you could that was why it was so exciting whenever new Xbox Live Arcade games came out, because you could at least try all of them for free every week.
Mm-hmm.
So even if you weren't buying many games, you're at least getting lots of free demos. And yeah, I would download a lot of them just to play them for 5 minutes out of sheer curiosity, because why wouldn't you? And a lot of times I would end up finding out, hey, this is really cool. I want to buy this. And I spent a lot of money that way. And I'm really surprised that no one's really doing that anymore, including even Microsoft. I don't even think they're doing that anymore.
I couldn't tell you. I mean, I haven't really downloaded many games.
I can tell you the last couple weeks of Xbox One's online shop has not been good. It's probably the best. It's been very Spartan, pun not intended.
Yeah, I mean,
they've still got Ori, which they should probably be pimping quite a bit.
Yeah,
and I mean, they are. They've put a lot of muscle behind that game. It's the same thing Nintendo's done with Space Adventures. Like, hey, we're gonna feature this every chance we get.
Yeah, and Sony with Axiom Verge.
Yep.
Yeah. So for the second part of the email, where he talks about some Nintendo and giving away third party games, now it's been a while. I'm not sure if I don't want to you know, misreport what the developer has said, but at some point I've read this Curve Studio guy being asked about if they were seeing anything from Fluidity Spin Cycle on the on Club Nintendo being given away, and I think the answer was no. They're not seeing anything. So, of course, Nintendo published that title, so it might have been the agreement that they had.
Right.
But I'm guessing that the reason why Nintendo didn't put third-party games on the Club Nintendo is because they would have to pay them. Like, they would have to disburse
They'd have
something.
To give them their cut.
That you can see how that would be extremely complicated when you're see if they just gave you gift credit like they did with the Wii U Digital Deluxe program.
Oh, that wouldn't be a problem.
Well, I mean, they would still have to. They'd still have to give the cut to the. I mean, the money is not just coming out of nowhere. They still have to pay the publisher the game.
It's simpler, I think, because the reward already has a monetary value. And so there's no negotiation needed for how much the third-party publisher is going to get if you decide to use your certificate on their game versus a game that Nintendo made, for instance. All those structures are already in place through the agreement with the shop. Once you put that $10 gift certificate or $5 gift certificate into your account, it's the same as cash in terms of who gets paid what cut do they get. The problem with Club Nintendo is it runs on these coins. And how many coins is a third-party game worth? And how do you translate that into Nintendo's cut and how much of it goes to the developer? Like, all that stuff is like you'd have to negotiate it on a case by case basis.
Yeah,
and
especially
that
since
sounds
those
like
games,
a nightmare. So
yeah, especially since
I think it all comes down to the coins.
Yeah, especially
which
since
probably getting away from.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially since some of those games that you could redeem on Club Nintendo would fluctuated in prices over the years. So, I mean, sometimes you can get that game for free or maybe like $5-$10 and you would still get like 50 or 60 coins from it. So it's right. not always like a monetary value of those coins.
Right. Yeah. The whole like value proposition of what is a coin worth, you know, if you're trying to translate that into the retail value of a game that you could trade that coin for, that calculation would be bonkers. Because there were such, especially towards the end, there was such a crazy diversity of games. You know, I mean, if you use your platinum for a game that normally retails for $40 versus a game that normally retails for $10, does that mean you're stupid? Well, not if you want the $10 game more than the $40 game. You know, but like, how do you translate any of that stuff into any kind of cash value, which you would have to do in order to negotiate a cut for a third party? You know, that just sounds dreadful. So that's probably one of the reasons that they want to get away from Club Nintendo is that it was restrictive. Like, they could only offer their own games for rewards. And maybe those are the games that they least want to offer, right? I think they'd be much happier to give away third-party stuff.
And those are probably the ones that, I mean, we talked
would
about on the show.
The most.
Well, we talked about on the show. We already own a lot of those games, so the reward system kind of sucks.
I like it.
It was of limited value and it was a very different value to different people depending on what your tastes were, what your buying habits were. So I think we answered those questions. So thank you everybody for writing in. We will probably have more emails next week because we still have a whole bunch. And if you send in a shorter question, we might hold it for a few weeks until the next Thunder round. Because I think we are going to keep doing that. We had a really good time with
Thunder.
It last week. And we got to cover a lot of ground, which we don't normally do. Usually it's like this week where we had three emails and it took up really more time than it should have. So I think the Thunder Round thing serves a good purpose. But if your email doesn't get read quickly, that might be the case that we're just holding on to it until the next opportunity. So with that, we will wrap up the show. Again, send your emails to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Start playing The Legend of Zelda Twilight Princess if you have not already, and hit up that forum thread if you want to participate in Retroactive and talk with other people who are also playing through the game just like we are. And you can check out Mr. Curtis Bonds where?
You can check me out on Twitter @CurtisBonds, where you can see me make dumb jokes, make realizations that Donkey Kong 64 was a game about monkeys who rap, eat watermelon, and shoot guns, which was a very unfortunate realization.
Yes.
You can see me on YouTube at two different places. You can see me on NWRTV, which is at youtube.com/NinWRTV. I'm working on a new episode of my satirical top 10 show, the Nintendo Top Tendo. Next episode is going to be
God
about...
God damn it.
Yeah, the next episode is going to be about the top 10 Mega Man bosses, and I think that will be the most legitimate list I've ever put out. You could also catch me on YouTube at youtube.com/KurtDog2GsGaming. I'm going to be working on more episodes of Please Sakurai, which is a series where I do dramatic readings of some of the weirdest and worst posts on the Smash Brothers Miiverse.
Oh, God.
And it's amazing. You should check those out.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite shows to do. And you could also check me out on a new website I launched last month called Backlog Gamers Club, where I do game streams every single weekday with a bunch of my friends, and you can chat along with me as I play through a lot of the games in my backlog. I'm currently playing through Ratchet and Clank: A Crack in Time on PS3, and I was playing Sonic Advance on the Game Boy Advance, which I've never actually played, and I'm having a lot of fun with it. And
that's actually pretty good, isn't it?
Oh yeah, it's really good. It's one of the best 2D Sonic games I've ever played, actually.
Yeah, I think that was the one that I think they made Sonic Rush off of that engine, if I remember correctly. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah, they made three of those advanced games and they did Sonic Rush and all that. Yep, so good. Yeah, that website is at backloggamers.club, and I do, like I said, I do streams every weekday at 4 p.m. Pacific.
And just you said .club.
Dot club, yeah, that's actually a new domain.
New top level domains.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm not surprised that it exists. I think that's just the first time I've heard someone say it out loud.
Yeah, that just came out like last year.
Dot club. Mm-hmm. Man. You crazy kids. Okay, yep. Well, Curtis, thanks so much for joining us this week. It's been great having you.
It's been a pleasure. I always love coming on this show.
Yeah, we love having you, man. And really, people, go check out Curtis's videos. They're great. They're really funny. And Curtis is a hell of an entertainer. I've watched you stream lots of stuff over the past couple years, and it's always a good time watching you play games and listening to your live commentary and all your interactions with everybody. It's a ton of fun.
Yeah, I love doing it. I'm glad you enjoy it.
I think you're the one who got me interested in doing it for the first time, actually.
Oh, cool.
And cool. I don't do it often, but when I do it's a lot of fun. It's kind of like doing a podcast, but also I have to play a game at the same time, and I find that it's very hard to juggle those things. So much respect, sir.
Yeah, it's the closest thing to a Double Dare physical challenge you could possibly do.
You have to be very coordinated, that's for sure. Okay, well, thanks everyone for listening. We'll be back next week right here on Radio Free Nintendo.
Bye.
Later.
Later.
DK64 is my guiltiest of pleasures.
Platonic, now I get it.